Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, May 5th, 1893, panic hits Wall Street as the U.S. economy endures a severe crash that marks the end of the agrarian dominance in the country and brings in a progressive era. I'm joined, as always, by Nicole Hammer of Columbia. Nikki, hello. Nice to chat with you again.
Hi, Jody.
So I just want to paint a little bit of a picture of the aftermath of the crash of 1893, and then we'll talk about what caused it and its legacy and so forth. But some of these numbers are just kind of stunning. In the wake of it, we have 500 banks closed, 15,000 businesses fail, farms cease operation. The unemployment rate hits 25% in Pennsylvania, 35% in New York, 43% in Michigan. Soup kitchens opening to feed people who are now out of work and don't have money. Policemen, this is such an interesting tidbit, policemen were stationed at railroad stations to turn away newcomers who were fleeing one city and trying to enter another. So there was this kind of lockdown, hunker down mode. Obviously, it evokes a little bit of a sense of what we're feeling now. But I will say, when we think about severe economic crashes and moments of downturn in this country's history, I don't think 1893 necessarily comes to mind for a lot of people, right?
Yeah. I mean, after 1929, when the stock market crashes and it leads to this decade-long depression in the United States and in much of the world, it sort of wipes away the historical memory of these really major upheavals in the economy in the late 19th century. I mean, 1893 isn't the only one. I mean, this is happening in the 1870s. It's kind of a regular feature of American economic life that every 10 to 20 years, yeah, you're having these massive collapses of the economy that people have to suffer their way through.
I think, as is the case with a lot of these moments, we kind of retrofit explanations backwards onto what caused this. But do we have any sense of why this crash was the way it was in 1893?
I mean, you can look at a lot of different things. The expansion of the railroad industry had come to an end. There were some things happening in overseas markets. There was deflation in crop prices, so farmers were really hurting. But I think that the best way to think about it is actually just to take a step back, to think about what was happening to the U.S. It was transitioning from a mostly agrarian economy, yeah, into a new industrial economy. And there weren't really any programs in place to help ease that transition. And so not only did you not have federal institutions that could sort of help the economy stay more stable, you also didn't have support programs for people who were newly out of work. So this is just a really tumultuous and painful time as a new economy is being born.
Yeah. And that transition to the economy, I mean, I'm a little out of, over my skis here. I'm not an economist, but I will say, in reading about this over and over, it felt like a lot of those transitions that you're describing were financed by debt. And, you know, I have not studied 1893, but I lived through 2008. And anytime you see a massive change in the way our economy is shaped up and it is financed through debt, you know, I think I've now learned to be a little skeptical of that and realize, oh no, you know, there's a crash coming.
Yeah. Even if you don't know a ton about economics, and I join you on this, I'm not an economic historian, but when an economy is over leveraged or when the major industries are over leveraged, something's going to give.
And in this particular case, just to clarify, it was, you know, it was a lot of farming and a lot of railroads that found themselves in that situation. Mm-hmm. But neither of us are economists, but luckily you're a political scientist. So let's talk a little bit about the political context here, because, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is because I really do think of it as part of a pivot between what we can roughly think of as the Gilded Age and then moving into the Progressive Era. So can you paint that picture of where we were in the mid-1890s and then what came and how this maybe helped in, I think, a pretty massive and significant shift in the sweep of American politics?
Sure. I mean, well, the late 19th century was known as the Gilded Age, and it got that name because it was a time when the American economy was going gangbusters. It was growing into what would become the biggest manufacturing economy in the world. But all of the gains went to only a few people at the top. 11 out of 12 million American families were living in poverty during this period. And so there was a real disconnect between all of this new glittering wealth being generated and often on ostentatious display in American cities and the workers, both in cities and in agricultural areas, who were losing out and who were constantly facing things like, for farmers, right? The railroads were charging them astronomical fees in order to get their goods to market. market. And so even when they had a really great year, they weren't seeing any of that money coming back to them. And that disconnect led to just massive political unrest. And when you add on top of that a major collapse like this, you start to get political movements agitating, not just for money to weather the storm, but for ways to prevent the next storm and maybe empower people mm-hmm. who didn't have a ton of power.
So we mentioned Williams Jennings, someone whose name I just can never say correctly. Why? Same. Why is that?
William, you want to say Bryant. You want to say Bryant. You want to say Jennings.
And you want to say Jennings, but William Jennings Bryan. William Jennings Bryan. We mentioned him a couple episodes ago and said that we would talk about him in this episode. So why is he such a key figure in the wake of the crash of 1893?
You know, he's a really charismatic leader who has real political legitimacy, and he is the person into whom all of this unrest flows. He becomes the standard bearer for the populace, and part of the reason he becomes that standard bearer is he doesn't just talk about tariffs and monetary policy, which people talked about a lot then, even lay people, but can be a rather dry subject. But he talked about it in deeply moral terms. He talked about mm-hmm. mankind being crucified on a cross of gold if we stayed on the gold standard. So there was this real sense of moral urgency to what he was saying and a real push for broad economic and institutional change. And even though he doesn't win, he fundamentally transforms the Democratic Party and makes it increasingly more reformist.
That mix between policy argument and a moral argument. It's so fascinating to me. How much does the moral side actually change the way people think? Because you see in a fairly short period here, public opinion really shift towards the role of government in protecting workers, a sort of more robust government, a stronger safety net. Is that because of policy reasons or moral reasons, as you put it?
I think those things are not disconnected, but I do think that the particular talent of being able to express a policy viewpoint in moral and ethical terms really matters, especially when it resonates with people. When you can say to people, you are working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you are impoverished, and if you hurt yourself on the job, you're out of luck. Nobody is going to help you. They, I think, understand the fundamental unfairness of that. And when you can point to someone else and say, and by the way, those are the people who have all of that wealth that you've created, that's a pretty powerful point. And that's ultimately what happens, right? There is a big effort and a successful effort, at least partially successful, to begin to balance the scales. I mean, you start to get the first income tax by 1913. You start to get, as we've talked about before, you get senators directly elected instead of picked by their cronies in the state legislature. So it's a pretty effective political movement.
I feel like one other element in what we're discussing here is also this sense of kind of a transformation within the economic, and I think we're sensing this a little bit now too. You know, a lot of industries that have existed for 30, 40 years are starting to go away, and there's a sort of frontier that we can feel ahead of us. That creates fertile ground to have the space to make that moral argument, whereas if it was just entrenched in existing systems, there's inertia, it's harder to kind of shake things up.
And overcoming inertia is really difficult, and so you have to have both a political movement that's making a moral argument, but that has the political imagination to envision a different world, and then the skill to figure out how you get there.
Okay, so I want to end with one last thing, which is you either telling me whether I should let my mind really look to this era as a blueprint and a template and having lots of lessons, because, you know, I have found more and more as I live through our current era, finding myself saying like, oh, right, we're in a new Gilded Age, and we might be in a new Progressive Age. And the template of wealth inequality and this moral argument and new industries and a crisis and all these things, it's playing out exactly that way. And I know that part of this show is kind of guarding against the pitfalls of finding tidy lessons from history, but then sometimes there are those lessons from history. So tell me how much I should look to this period and say, oh, that's the path we're walking on.
So I think that this is a good period to look to for precisely the reasons that you were just talking about, that we are shifting to a new economy. We have been in the process of shifting to a new economy, and it's taken our institutions much too long to actually shift and fit that new context. And in fact, this would be true of the American economy in this era as well. You get some changes in the 19-teens, but it's not until the New Deal that you finally get a set of structures that make the economy a little better for the people who had been losing out earlier on. So one of the lessons is that this kind of change takes a lot of energy, it takes a lot of time, and these things move really slowly. I think another big lesson from this period, you know, you have two classes of people who are losing out in this period. You have industrial workers in the cities and you have farmers. And there were real efforts in the 1890s to get these two on the same page against a common enemy, these capitalists who were taking all of their money. And it actually turned out to be really difficult to do. Those alliances were never forged because the people were split between the two parties. The farmers were in the Democratic Party and the industrial workers in the Republican Party. And figuring out ways to overcome those divisions and create something new is really difficult.
All right. So I think your answer is very responsible. There are parallels, but don't get too caught up in it all.
Yeah, that's always my answer.
All right. Nikki Amrit, thank you as always.
Thanks, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. You can find out lots more about the show, including how to suggest the topic at thisdaypod.com. Also, now on that site, we've posted our theme music for you to download. A number of people have asked about our theme music. It's by Teen Days. You can find the full thing on our site right now and download it if you want. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Thursday, a very different story lined up for you, one you probably haven't heard about. It's about a trailblazing female legislator whose career was cut short by a single letter. And that episode also has a special guest, a little bit of a reunion for me. I'm very excited about it. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.